You're trying to say, well, what's my net worth? What bills do I have to pay?
And I'm just betting on the track record of, you know, the economy over decades, and that's why I'm betting on it, not the short term.
The uncertainty of how long will our money last?
You know, those are things that are on your mind sometimes at 3 o'clock when you wake up and you're trying to figure out how to balance your budget.
Those were your voices, your thoughts, and worries. Because for the past couple weeks, we've been doing an economic gut check of sorts on our website, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the phone.
Hi, it's Lizzie O'Leary, and you've reached Marketplace Weekend. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
Well, you heard me say it. I am Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, a show that starts with you and then touches on all parts of how the economy intersects with our lives. Our finances, of course, our legal system, politics, even the movies we watch. So stick around and talk back on Facebook, on Twitter, we're at Marketplace WKND there, and our website, marketplaceweekend.org. We've always asked you on this show to talk to us, to go to our site, write us, tweet us, call us. We want to take that to the next level now. You heard me steal that question from Ronald Reagan. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And I don't mean it politically, but in your bank account or the way you feel about the economy. Linda Harlow from Dallastown, Pennsylvania, came to us through Facebook. She's 64, and she said, not really. In 2012, she was laid off. She had a series of temp jobs until December 2013 and now works part-time in a department store. She started collecting Social Security at 63, when she really wanted it at 70. All of this has put her under a lot of stress.
Well, yeah, it has. I mean, we, for a while, were paying two mortgages because we had bought a house, a ranch house, because I really need one floor living. I'm getting arthritis and going up and down lots of stairs is not a good thing. And we were trying to sell our condominium, which was three levels. So, you know, we had two mortgages to pay up until 2013. And it does put a strain. I mean, we don't go on vacations anymore. We're limited as to what we can do because my income was cut.
Corinne Cooper, a communications consultant in Tucson, Arizona, is also in her early 60s. She's on the edge of retirement, and the economy is not where she envisioned it to be when she imagined retiring. Still, she thinks she is better off now than in 2011.
I am better off because the stock market has come back. I am not better off because my income has increased or because my other assets like my home have increased in value. In Tucson, where the real estate market has really crashed, those kinds of investments have not come back. But because the stock market has improved fairly dramatically, I am better off.
Drew Abbas, a 52-year-old business analyst from Ohio, also came to us through Facebook. We called him, and he says he thinks he's pretty middle of the road when we asked whether he was doing better now than 4 years ago.
I think I'm pretty much status quo. My earnings have increased a little bit, but so have my expenses with two girls entering their teenage years, getting more and more expensive.
Yeah. So when you have kids, I would imagine as teenagers, you are looking out into the future, presumably thinking about college. What keeps you up at night thinking about the economy?
Well, as particular to college, you're right. The cost of college, which continues to seem to outpace inflation, has me a bit worried. We have a particular university in sight for our oldest, who is now 15. And if they're continuing to raise their tuition, that's an issue for us, and we definitely have to watch out for that. That kind of has us worried as far as college for our girls.
Cindy Gill has worked as a nurse for the last 30 years, and she summed up our question with one word, uncertainty. In the 1970s, when she entered the workforce, she said there was a guarantee. It was the era of pensions and gold watches. She spoke to me from her home in Texas.
In the last 4 years, we've seen the ups and downs of the stock market and there are just no guarantees there. So we can try and invest our money wisely, but, you know, with booms and busts and bubbles and fees that are added on to the financial products that are available to us, you just wonder, if I live to be 90, I'm going to be eating cat food at that age because my money will have run out. So I think it's the uncertainty.
Thank you all so much for your calls and comments. We love hearing from you, and we want to keep this conversation going from week to week and show to show. We heard so much anxiety from everyone we spoke to this week, even the people who called and we couldn't get you on the air. So here's what we want to know for next week. What do you need to feel secure? And how do you define that in your life? What are the specific things you're looking for? I'll be chatting with you online throughout the week and on the air right here next week. So let's talk. Find us on Marketplace's Facebook page, on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND, or you can give us a call at 1-800-648-5114. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. The economic world is often filled with ridiculous jargon. Two big ones, long and short. As in, you are long this thing, you think it's good, it's a bet that will pay off, yada yada. Or short, betting against it. So let's do the news equivalent of that in our new segment, Long or Short, with Marketplace's own Mark Garrison and Jillian White from The Atlantic. Welcome.
Hey.
All right.
Hi. I want to know, when you look out into the future, Jillian White, what are you short? What are you sick of? What do you no longer want to discuss?
I mean, the thing that I no longer want to discuss, but will have to discuss forever, apparently, is the debt ceiling. I just feel like, how many times are we going to have this conversation? It's consistently going to go down to the wire, and then it'll get taken care of, but not without all of this drama and rolling it over in the media and all of this political partisanship. It's exhausting, but it'll never go away, and we will have to cover it forever.
Oh, man, and it's on our show this week. I you know, we're both long and short the debt ceiling. Short it because it never goes away, and long because it never goes away.
Exactly. There's no option here, for reporters at least. For politicians, there is, and it just seems to not be getting taken care of. So I think it's frustrating. But, I mean, on the upside, I feel like before, maybe a decade ago, a lot of people didn't even know anything about the debt ceiling. So learning opportunity?
Yeah, I guess so. Mark Garrison, what are you long?
I am long boring banking. I mean, we have seen, as big regulations have come through, the Volcker Rule, all this fun stuff, all the crazy stuff that the big banks did, you know, those fun derivatives and trading and things like that, that is not proving to be as important and as profitable a part for the major banks. That's moving out into other darker, you know, more sexier worlds of finance. And the things that bankers find dull and boring, like savings accounts and credit cards and consumer banking and mortgages, those things are actually becoming really important
again.
Just
like straight up vanilla banking?
No, banks the way you actually humans think of a bank. And that's becoming important, and that's not the worst thing in the world.
All right, I'll go with that. Jillian, you were long one of the more fascinating legal cases that I've heard about in a long time. I'm really interested in student loans. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this I think is really interesting. So it's this case. The guy's name is Robert Murphy. The case is in Boston. He is 65 years old, has just about $250,000 worth of student loan debt that he is carrying because he sent his three kids to college. And he used to work at a manufacturing plant, and he has been essentially out of work, I believe, since around 2002. So his point is, I want to file for bankruptcy, but if I file for bankruptcy, these student loans aren't getting discharged. I will still have $250,000 to pay back. And even if I find a job where I'm making about $50,000 a year, by the time he's, you know, 77 years old, if he continues working, it still won't be paid down. And with interest, it will actually, you know, have ballooned up a bit. So the issue is that when you file for bankruptcy in this country, your student loans don't get discharged. So you can get rid of your credit card debt. You can get rid of all these other things, but you may still be sitting on this mountain of student loans. So the court asked the Department of Education to weigh in on this. The Department of Education, of course, was like, no, absolutely not. You should not discharge this man's student loans at all. This is his fault for taking them out so late in life. And also, working past the age of 65 does not constitute a real hardship. And I just think it's a really fascinating case because it takes a look at, you know, one of the main ways that people have to get out from underneath a substantial amount of debt. And it kind of shines a light on the fact that that doesn't work at all for one of the most pernicious forms of debt that we're dealing with today.
Mark, I'm going to let you go for the fun and go for the short, because talking about this segment was actually your idea.
We'll see. Okay, so I am short urban hobbyist chicken or beekeepers. I'm just going to scream if I read like another article. Or
you do live in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah. And again, it's happening all these other places like that. It's not even that common. It's just like places that like to write style section type articles have gone to these people. But I declared a top on that particular market when someone told me, and I thought they were joking. I thought they were pulling my leg, that there is a $1,500 cedar chicken coop available for your backyard provided by Williams-Sonoma. Williams-Sonoma is now not in just the business of really expensive things that you would put on
your wedding registry
or something like that. They're actually selling chicken coops. And I think it was a combination chicken coop and chicken run. I was familiar with the film, but I didn't realize that that was also a type of chicken accommodation. So yes, I think the bar should be raised for a style section to – you at least need to have a goat or better still a milk cow. If you have an urban backyard garden, there's a milk cow. I think that's unusual enough, but I am rejecting any more discussion of these urban beekeepers or urban chicken coop people.
I will actually join you in that short, because somewhere in Harlem, there is a family of roosters that crows every morning for 3 hours, and it drives me crazy. So I'm on that team.
Jillian White, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Mark Garrison, reporter here at Marketplace. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. We've got our digital producers, Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe, with a look at some of the other economic stories of the week by the numbers. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$67 billion.
That's how many dollars Dell paid for the cloud computing company EMC.
It's the largest tech buyout in history.
It also makes Dell a new and large player in the cloud.
$862
million. That's how much money Apple could end up paying in fines to the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
The charge? Infringing on a patent held by the school.
The technology in question is used to improve processing efficiency in some of Apple's iPhones and iPads.
$800,000.
That's how many people currently subscribe to Playboy magazine.
In 1975, that number was 5.6 million.
The magazine announced this week it would be rebranding, focusing on content like investigative journalism and lifestyle coverage.
That also means the magazine will stop featuring pictures of nude women. But where will people go to find this content now?
Yeah, where are they gonna go?
You could be forgiven if your head starts to spin when you hear the words debt ceiling, because honestly, mine does too. I used to cover Congress, and I have done this dance more times than I care to count. And we are guilty, as Jillian White pointed out earlier, of covering it, because, you know, it's important. But here we are again. Time is running out, and the Treasury Secretary Jack Lew just told Congress this week that, oops, they have less time than he previously warned until the government runs out of cash. Back to talk about his favorite topic, our Washington bureau chief, Dave Shaw. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Lizzie.
So Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, essentially put out a little letter that said, hey, everybody, raise the debt ceiling or else. What did he say?
He's updating what he has been saying for a while now. So quick history lesson. The U.S. Authorizes money to be spent and then only later authorizes the borrowing that is necessary for that spending. So that's what we're talking about. And so right now the limit's $18,113,000,000,000, give or take. And we hit that back in March. And so in between March and now, we've been violating the spirit of the law but not the letter by, you know, not making some payments to some accounts and moving money around. It's sort of like the government equivalent of, like, looking in the cushions for change.
And Lou's letter essentially changed the date on when those couch cushions would expire, saying it would be November 3rd, not November, what, 5th or 6th. Can you walk me through, though, what the or else would mean?
So the thing is, we don't really know what or else means, right? So because this is really uncharted territory if the U.S. is unable to meet its obligations. And just to be clear, we're talking about spending that the Congress already authorized. It already said, yes, we are going to spend this money on, you know, every appropriation that the government makes. You know, they pay like 80 million, they write 80 million checks, they're not literal checks, but they make 80 million payments every month, right? So, like, that's a lot of money going out. And that's one of the reasons, that's one of the reasons that it's really hard for Jack Lew and others to say when exactly they're going to run out of money, because there's a great word, which is lumpy. That's what the economists use to describe this. It's lumpy. The money coming in is lumpy. You never know how much is going to come in on a given day. And so what the secretary is saying is, on November 3rd, we have so little money at our disposal that we're not going to be able to make – we're going to bounce checks. We're not going to be able to pay people.
Listeners, and I have to admit, me – are a little tired of this dance that happens a lot. But there is a new wrinkle this time. Who is in charge of negotiating on the Republican side of the table at this point?
Well, so, of course, the subtext here is that the House Speaker, John Boehner, said a couple weeks back that, you know, he was ready to leave the job. And he said, I'm going to leave at the end of October. And then there's been some trouble in finding his replacement. And so, you know, he said, I'm not going to leave the speakership vacant at the end of the month. So, you know, I think what it seems like is going to happen is he'll stay on. And then so the conversations about raising the debt limit are happening. And it's the same players that we've had. You know, so you have on the Democratic side in the Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, and on the Republican side, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner.
And these political conversations are, of course, twinned with very real consequences for every single American and their financial wherewithal if this all falls apart.
Right. And it's uncharted, right? It's unclear what would happen. There are predictions of great financial bedlam on the far end. And I think on the near end, you think, well, the borrowing costs are going to go up. You may remember Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S. debt and its ability to pay it in 2011 after the U.S. got within a couple of days of default. And so this is
and they blamed politics.
Yeah, this is the dance that keeps unfolding. You know, I think there's been 14 debt limit increases since 2001. And so that's, you know, it's about one a year that we do. And that's just sort of the nature of governing right now.
How does the calendar figure into all of this? How much time does Congress have left?
Well, Congress, the House has been on a recess this past week, and so they'll get back. And, the date that you want to be thinking about is Tuesday, November 3rd. That's the date that Secretary Lew says is X date, as it's called in these discussions.
Dave Shaw, our Washington Bureau Chief, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I want to turn from our political system to our legal one, and a part of it that has its roots in medieval England. That's when courts regularly started requiring defendants to pay bail or bond. The idea was that paying would make sure that they would come back for their court dates. Hundreds of years later, we still do that.
I just got out of jail. I was in jail for like 6 days for driving on a suspended license. So it's a very interesting experience.
This is Jared. Our producer, Jenny Ament, met him at a county jail in Los Angeles.
Bail was very helpful, though. Is that your question? Bail got me out of jail. So otherwise, I would have been in there for another 16 days. Okay, well, my business that I started 2 months ago would have suffered, and you know, my 7-year-old child at home would have suffered. My whole family would have suffered. You know, we have rent to pay and everything, business, workers. So, yeah, bail got me out of jail. I can't imagine not having a bail. So
how do you pay for it?
I paid for it by my girlfriend paying for it at the bail bondsman's office. And I think she put maybe like 2% down, and I'll pay the 8% balance. So it's 10% on the full bail is the bond. And then you get out and then you pay.
Do you think that that's kind of like unfair because people without the money might not be able to pay it?
I mean, that's just the way the system is. So, yeah, it's not really unfair because if you don't have the money, then, I mean, it's a broader social economic problem, I believe.
Jared's last question has come up a lot lately. As we learn more about people who stay locked up because they can't afford to post bail. Here in New York, that's about 50,000 people a year. Often for amounts that are so small, they aren't worth the business for bail bondsmen who generally require a percentage down and then lend the rest. Several states have dropped commercial bail. Kentucky, Illinois, Oregon, Wisconsin, and others. We went to see one of the loudest voices trying to change the commercial bail system, New York's own chief judge, Jonathan Lippman. I started by reading his own words back to him, where he called the system ass backwards.
I'm trying to be appropriate, but yes, I believe it is totally ass backwards, 100%.
So how did we end up like this?
Well, look, this is a system that goes back forever. I think that it has not evolved with everything else in the justice system. And I don't know what its purpose is today.
So let's use New York City as sort of a laboratory experiment here. Earlier in the summer, the mayor said, okay, some misdemeanor offenders, we are going to not use commercial bail here. We're going to use some other different tools. That was in July. What's happened?
Well, there's a lot of those things going on. And I'm doing something which I think will really make a difference. I'm very hopeful that it will, where every misdemeanor case, after the judge makes the bail decision at arraignment, we're going to have another judge within about 10 days review that bail to take a good look at it. And on felony cases, we're going to periodically, like every 90 days, have those cases in and let the prosecutor say where their witnesses, where they're ready to go. We're also going to train our judges on other kinds of bail. And we're also going to be experimenting with electronic supervision, you know, bracelets and that kind of thing. It cost pennies to do that compared to keeping someone incarcerated.
Before I came to see you, though, I talked to some public defenders and I talked to some criminal justice reform advocates who said, the flip side of this, though, is that bail does make the court system move. If you take away commercial bail, is this just going to clog up the court system to the point where an already overtaxed system and already overtaxed prosecutors and defense attorneys can't even get their cases through? That's the worry.
The short answer is no.
How?
It is ridiculous. There are places in this country, including Washington, D.C., that have done away with cash bail entirely. And the system still functions, believe it or not. And it is just not the case that the system would break down without it. And we'll get there. You don't have to do away with cash bail tomorrow. But what you do have to do is flip that presumption immediately. Change this idea that people should be incarcerated at great cost to the taxpayer because of how much money they have in their pocket.
Are there cases of yours that you remember?
There are cases that we have every day. Yes, where people are in for no reason that one could explain, and it's ruined their lives. Yes, I think.
Do you feel responsible?
Do I feel responsible?
Yeah.
Every time you have a case like that, you shake your head and you say, what is our justice system supposed to be? But we all should be responsible.
Oh, wait, shouldn't you feel responsible,
yes,
though?
Yes, I was just going to say. And the bottom line is we're all responsible. We're all responsible. And as the chief judge, I feel particularly responsible. And I'm not going to shut up about it until we change the whole statutory framework in New York. Within the coming year or few years, we're going to have reform of our bail system. This is about justice. And the bail system today is not about justice.
Judge Littman, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We are trying something new here at Marketplace Weekend. We want to hear your stories about money that are happening right in your neighborhood, what you think is worth talking about. And you can hear more details about a project we're calling Local Money. You can see them on our website, marketplaceweekend.org. This week, a controversial proposal by Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges was scaled back. It would have forced businesses to pay employees who had had their shifts canceled. It was one part of her working families agenda, and it's got labor and businesses at odds. We've got reporter Curtis Gilbert from our sister network, Minnesota Public Radio, here to explain. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right. So before we get into the sort of battle of what's going on right now, can you explain the background of this proposal? This was something that Mayor Hodges wanted and was part of her working families agenda, right?
The fair scheduling, yes. So the working families agenda is something that the mayor of Minneapolis rolled out in concept earlier this year. And about 6 weeks ago, they finally started to put some specifics behind these proposals. And so the working families agenda had three basic parts. One involved giving workers more predictability for their work schedules. Another one would guarantee everyone who works in the city paid sick leave. And a third part dealt with something they called wage theft.
And the fair scheduling part of this I found sort of fascinating, and I want you to explain both what it was and then how it got tanked. I mean, the idea that, okay, you got to lay out a schedule and then, oh, that falls apart and you have to pay me if it doesn't work. Wow, that seems like something that businesses would just go bananas about.
Yes, I think bananas would be a mild term for the reaction from the business community here. So this is really an idea that was born in San Francisco. San Francisco is the only city in the country that's passed something like this. And it just went into effect there this year. And basically, the idea of it is that workers are having their schedules changed at the last minute. It makes it difficult for them to find childcare, to take second jobs, to pursue education, even to have like a social life. And so it would essentially give them a right to know their schedule a certain amount of time in advance or to be compensated, kind of like getting overtime kind of thing. You'd get an extra hour of pay if your schedule was changed. The specific proposal in Minneapolis started out to be very broad, very much broader than what they have in place right now in San Francisco. So the San Francisco proposal applies only to your big chain retailers, restaurants, and hotels, places like that. The Minneapolis proposal, by contrast, would have applied to every employer in the city. So every mom and pop restaurant. And so the face of the opposition to this in Minneapolis was, of course, a very sympathetic one. You know, it's small business owners who say, look, we can't set our schedules. Originally, the proposal was 4 weeks in advance. You know, the weather happens. We heard this from, people who run restaurants that have outdoor patios. You know, we could try to set the schedule, in September for October. Well, it might snow in October,
right,
in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Then we're going to close the patio. Like, we can't, and we're operating on thin margins. And so we have to be able to change our schedules in response to changing business conditions.
So now that this has gone away, what is happening with the rest of this agenda and plan?
Well, right. Because the opposition to this scheduling issue was so strong and so vociferous and so well organized, it actually had pulled a lot of attention away from other parts of the proposal, which are probably potentially more popular and less controversial. And the main one there is this guarantee of sick time. About 40% of American workers have no access to paid sick leave. And that number is much higher once you talk about part-time workers, low-income workers, hourly workers, people from minority communities disproportionately, do not have access to sick time. I think the calculation that the politicians in Minneapolis made was that there was perhaps less opposition to this idea of sick leave. Of course, lots of businesses provide paid sick leave already, so there are going to be fewer people who are going to be opposed to this because they're already doing it, right? And there's also a lot more of a precedent for the sick leave part of the thing. There are 4 states, 19 cities, and 1 county in the U.S. that already have some kind of mandatory paid sick leave, you know, and the details of these all vary because they're all in different places. But so there's a lot more of a track record for that. And so I think they figured focus on the thing that's a little more likely to pass and try to cut back the opposition, which was becoming, as we learned this week, overwhelming to the fair scheduling part of it.
Curtis Gilbert from Minnesota Public Radio, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's what's happening in Minneapolis. What's going on in your neighborhood? Tell us at marketplaceweekend.org. We might just pick yours out and talk about it on air and online. Oscar winner Jennifer Lawrence made headlines for an essay about discovering she earned significantly less money than her male co-stars. Hollywood is a heavily male industry. Our Adrian Hill covers entertainment and recently sat down with one of the industry's most successful directors, who happens to be a woman. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
You're our guide to the entertainment industry, and you spent some time watching a new movie, talking to the director. Tell me about it.
I got to take an early look at a film called Miss You Already. It's basically a love story between two women best friends. It stars Toni Collette, Drew Barrymore, and it's directed by a woman named Catherine Hardwicke. You might know her from 13 or Twilight. I actually headed over to Catherine's house and office in Venice to talk with her some about it, and she told me it would have been really tough to get this movie made here in Los Angeles.
We didn't make it in this town. We made it in London with British money. You know, it's just very difficult to, as we know what the odds are. We've been, you know, talking about them a lot, how few movies written by a woman get made, how few movies directed by a woman fewer get made, and how few starring two women over 35 get made. So, you know, it has all the odds against it, plus a difficult subject. It's not like a broad comedy or something.
She's talking about gender there. There's a huge focus on gender in Hollywood right now. You guys got into a long conversation about that. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to give some background numbers here, in 2014, last year, women only directed 7% of the top 250 grossing films. So directors,
wow.
Yeah, female directors seem very underrepresented when you're talking about these big budget movies. But before I get into the conversation I had with her, I have to sort of start with a digression. It's been incredibly hot in Los Angeles. So we're at her house. The coolest room in her house is her bedroom. So I wind up doing this interview on her bed that turns out to be a very famous bed. This is the bed, Lizzie, where Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson auditioned. The stars from 13 met here. So we're on this bed. I was sitting on this little piece of movie history. It's kind of amazing. But to get back to our conversation about gender. So we're sitting, we're talking, and she tells me that for years in her career, she thought she was struggling because she just wasn't working hard enough, because she didn't have the break. So then she directs Twilight, which made almost $400 million worldwide. She was in the Guinness Book of World Record for the biggest opening weekend by a woman director. And she thought that would open all these doors for her.
You know, I would try to get interviews on other films, and they would literally tell my agent, oh, we want to hire a man for that job.
Wow.
Even though the men that they hired, that you could add up all of their movies, didn't even make as much as one of my, as that one of my movie. So it wasn't about money. It wasn't about, you know, skill or awards or this or that. It was, I started to understand the gender bias.
What did it feel like to realize this bias was real after Twilight came out and then you weren't getting those jobs?
How can anybody work harder than me, you think, you know, pity party, like I did so much preparation and I've worked for so many guy directors. They just walked out on set. They didn't even know what they were shooting. You know, it's frustrating. But, you know, of course, we all think let's take the negative and turn it into a positive. This year, this could change. We could stop having this conversation and have much more interesting and diverse films, too.
Do you feel like being a woman has affected your bottom line and your career as a director?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the statistics are irrefutable. How can you say no? Look at the amount of movies that men have directed and how much they've made, and look what women have directed and what they've made. You can't even have a brain and dispute the facts. You know, there's no intelligent way to say that women aren't affected by this kind of bias. That's why I think it's great that ACLU took it up.
And what about your agents in representation? What do they say about all of this? Have they ever said, hey, don't speak up as much?
Truthfully, in the past, in the PR field, at agencies and different things say, you know, you've got to be careful on the code word woman issues, like female issues, like being emotional on set and things like that, you know. So those things definitely have come up. Here's another example of a gender bias. My boyfriend made a micro-budget movie, and he found a sales agent to go out and sell the movie. And she said, my boyfriend's name is Jamie. She said, listen, if we could put James, which is not his name, as directed by James, then we would have a much better chance of selling it, because if it says Jamie, there's a 50-50 chance the director could be a woman, and that's going to hurt sales.
What year was that?
This year. Yeah.
What did Jamie do?
What did he do? Oh, well, that's not his – James is not his name, so he just left his name on it, you know. But, I mean, just the idea – that there's a 50-50 chance it could be directed by a woman. Well, that's going to be a detriment to selling the film. That's pretty bad. You know, we have these incredible situations that we're facing in the world that we need to change. I mean, there's no question about it.
Catherine, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. It's a great, important subject. I love it that you guys are covering this.
Adrian, Catherine Hardwick referenced the ACLU in your conversation with her there. Can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So the ACLU has for a while now been interviewing women directors. I think they've now done 80 interviews with directors in the city, talking about their experiences trying to get work. They, in May, called on the EEOC and other government agencies to really investigate. They're calling it a civil rights violation. And their reports now, the EEOC is following up. It's setting interviews with many women directors. It's actually jumping into this. So it's a very interesting time. We don't know much about this investigation, but we do know that more and more people are taking it seriously.
And do you get the sense from Catherine Hardwick that she thinks things are going to change?
I think she's optimistic. I think that there's a sense this has been happening for a really long time. And right now, because of the efforts by the ACLU, because more and more women directors are standing up and saying, wait, I feel like I've been discriminated against, people are starting to pay attention. So I would say she's optimistic that things could change.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
What's up, Lizzie?
So why did you drag me outside on the street here today?
Well, it's a beautiful day, but also I want to talk about how stupid technology is making us.
Thank you.
Just kidding. I know, all of us. I'm kidding, but only sort of. Okay, so I thought we could play a little game. Have you heard of the phrase digital amnesia?
Digital amnesia.
Maybe you heard it and you forgot it. Okay, so do you remember your childhood home's phone number?
Yes. 202 for my mom. 202 for my dad.
Okay,
what's
all right.
Yours?
That's good. Mine has been, and still is.
What's up, Connecticut?
Yeah, Connecticut, baby. But what about, like, a more sort of recent phone number? Phone number to the office, maybe? The New York office?
I have literally no idea what the number to the office is.
Do you see what I'm getting at here? Some of these older numbers from when we were kids we had to memorize these numbers.
Yeah.
It became kind of second nature. Digital amnesia is this idea that we've become so reliant on our smartphones and computers to remember things, we're not building permanent memories.
Oh my God, you're right. The people who I call nowadays, my favorites are just my favorites.
Right. And in a way, this is a good thing, Lizzie. We've outsourced a bunch of these menial memory tasks to machines that can do it better, right? Your temporary or what's called working memory brain storage is supposed to be able to hold about 10 items in it. We're talking digits, shapes, names, stuff like that. You know how a computer has RAM?
Yeah.
Random access memory. So it's kind of like that. But think of a phone. Because I'm super popular, obviously. I have 2,000 contacts in my phone.
You think I'm going to let that skate by? Really?
But I can't remember 2,000, right?
All right, hit me with the downside, the amnesia, because yes. I know it is coming.
Yes. Well, Lizzie, the most recent study of brains shows that brains are elastic. They're malleable. The kind of input we take into our most precious machine actually changes it physically. We're in possession of this kind of incredible computer, right, that physically changes depending on what we put into it. We're using phones in a way to act as an extension to our brains for information. There was a study recently at the University of Birmingham in the UK where researchers looked at memory habits of 6,000 adults in Europe. More than 33% would have to look up something on a computer or a phone to remember it, a third of people.
Wow. I'm going to assume that we didn't used to have to do that and presumably used to be able to remember some stuff. And we remember some things.
Yeah, and, you know, we used to be kind of better at this stuff. There's actually an author named Nicholas Carr who's written a lot about this so-called Google effect. And people who have studied this have discovered that we use computers in the same way we'd use a friend or a family member or a colleague. It's kind of crowdsourcing in real life, and now it's gone digital. So do you want to try and get somebody and see if they can tell us something from memory without looking at their phone?
Yes. Excuse me. Could we ask you a quick question?
Can you tell me where 797 Third Avenue is?
This is 767. So it might be down towards the left because it'll go down as you go downtown.
Amazing. Okay, so you just proved one of our points. We were curious whether people would take out their smartphones or not. You actually had a smartphone
in your
hand.
In your hand.
But you didn't look it up. You didn't Google it, and you didn't even look at the map.
You know where you are. You don't have your phone. How are you going to get around?
Do you consider yourself someone who relies on your smartphone when you look things up or not?
I try not to. But, I mean, it's available. It's easy, so why not sometimes? But, I mean, just common sense.
Ben, I think you and I are dumber than the rest of the population. Well, and this brings up, I think, what is scary about the idea of digital amnesia on a deep level. When I look at much younger people, this is a question I raise. I was driving with my godson and his 9-year-old brother last weekend, and they said, how do you know where you're going? You're not looking at your phone. And I said, I just know the way. And he said, what do you mean? How do you know the way if it's not in your phone? I said, because I know where I'm going.
Right. And this is the potentially scary side of all this, is that in the effort to build ways for us to not have to think about the simple things so that we can think more deeply, so that we have more brain space to do the things we really want to do, we're building these machines to do all of this kind of simple, shallow thinking for us. In a way, that also potentially makes our own thinking more shallow because we don't build in these memories. We don't train our brains to remember this stuff at a deeper level. And in some ways, that could impact the way that our brain actually develops over time.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Now we have a story about what many people spend their weekends watching and multi-billion dollar conflicts of interest, or potential ones. You be the judge after you hear this story. It's all about sports, doctors, and keeping very expensive athletes safe. Lee Eagle is an associate professor at NYU, where he's also co-director of the Sports and Society Department. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
We are going to start with this story about Jose Mourinho and the English Premier League. For those of us who are blindly American, We should remind ourselves that the English Premier League is a $3 billion moneymaker. This thing just rakes it in.
Oh, Lizzie, it rakes it in, continues to rake it in while we're sitting here talking about it. It's raking it in.
So what happened with Mourinho and the team's doctor?
Mourinho, at the near the end of a game, 2-2 versus Swansea.
And Mourinho is the manager of Chelsea.
Mourinho's the manager of Chelsea. And one of the players went down near the end of the game. And before he got up, the medical staff was called out. The referee actually called out. So that's an important little piece there. And medical staff came running out on the field. Mourinho yelled at the staff to try to pull them back. They ended up still going out, tended to the player, and then came back. And really where things blew up was in a post-game press conference where Mourinho continued, I think it's fair to say berating, depends who you ask, but continued berating the team's medical staff and then ultimately demoted two members of the medical staff, the team physician and the physiotherapist or the physical therapist.
So I look at this and say, well, okay, so the manager of a soccer club in England yells at the team's doctor about, you know, letting some guy keep playing. Why is this a big deal?
Well, there's a real story here about professional athletes and the way that they're treated by coaches and managers and the way they're treated by medical staff and the way that they treat themselves. And really what we're talking about here is something that's sort of classic to business, which is conflicts of interest.
When you talk about, say, the medical staff in a situation like Chelsea's, who do they work for, right? Do they work for the players? Do they work for the team? Do they work for the coach? Or analogous, you know, when you're talking about the NFL, the NBA, who are they advocating for?
Well, you ask two really good and different questions. Mm. One is who do the team physicians or the team medical staff, who do they work for and who do they advocate for? And those really are two different things. And that's really where the conflict of interest arises. And remember, physicians and members of a team medical staff are human beings. We tend to forget that doctors are human beings. It's the practice of medicine. But this is where the conflicts of interest really crop up, because if we were sitting in what we would call a cold environment, sort of in a classroom for the most part, not my classroom, but you know, classrooms where there are nice ideas and we can talk about things in theory. You know, we would ask people, if in this situation, how do you think you would behave? And most people, pulling on their better selves, drawing on their better selves, would say, oh, well, I would let the medical staff go out on the field and attend to the player and see what needed to be done. Now, that's different than what we'd call a hot environment where this is really happening. So this is in the heat of the moment. This is in the throes of the game. And you have a number of different actors here. You have the coach or manager. You've got the team medical staff. You've got the player. You've got the player's teammates. You've got the owner sitting up in the box. You've got the fans who are in the stands. There's a lot going on here.
You got advertisers who've got their, you know, their signs all over the stadiums.
Oh, we didn't even get to the advertisers and sponsors, right? So there's a lot, really, there's a lot riding here on the bottom line.
Do you ever think we will see a shift where physicians and other medical staff will not be hired by the team, but there will be some other type of arrangement?
You know, it's tough to say. We're looking at some models where maybe the league actually does it in the same way that referees are hired. But I think there again, you're probably just adding another layer to an already tough situation.
Lee Eagle, associate professor at NYU and co-director of the Sports and Society Department. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're continuing our conversation with you. We want to know what it would take for you to feel secure. And how do you define that in your life? What are the specific things you're looking for? You can chat with me throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. And you can call us at 1-800-648-5114. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament, Raghu Manavalan, and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Congratulations to Dan on his upcoming wedding. Thanks for listening. This is APM.